Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, Russia Redux. And Richard, we'll start today with this story that we just can't seem to shake. The continuing fight now between the House Judiciary Committee and the Justice Department, specifically Attorney General Barr, over the fact that the DOJ has defied subpoenas from the committee for the unredacted version of the Mueller report and the underlying evidence. The Justice Department claims that what they're being asked to do here is essentially illegal. So who's got the better side of the legal argument here, Richard?
Well, this is something that is yet to be determined, but the basic presumption is a very strong one, namely that all grand jury proceedings are supposed to be confidential. It's a very strong one that you do not release information about ongoing investigations that could prejudice people, and it's a very strong presumption that you don't release information about collateral persons who've done nothing wrong who might be caught in the vortex on this. So all of the particular claims that the Barr is going to put forward in order to assert the privilege are certainly in place. The question that you always ask when you have a privilege is there's something on the other side that you balance against it that overrides it, which generally speaking is going to be something pressing with respect to a national emergency of the highest order. And certainly when you go back to the great case in 1974 of the United States against Nixon, the odds were, look, we have to get this information because Mr. Jaworski, who was put in the place of Archibald Cox, wanted it in order to see whether there was information there that was probative on the question of whether or not criminal charges made against some of Nixon's associates in a case in which Nixon was an unindicted co-conspirator could be supported by some of the conversations which the president had reported. And the Supreme Court went through this particular issue, and they thought that that issue was strong enough in this particular context to allow for the presentation of this stuff. The case came down on July 24th, I think, 1974, and within 2 weeks, President Nixon had resigned, so we never actually saw the way in which the information played out. But I think under these circumstances, we could talk about it more later, is that the administration is on relatively strong ground, and that I think Mr. Nadler is on quite weak ground.
Can you give us a sense of the historical backdrop on executive privilege? Where does this concept come from? Does it have clear parameters? You know, how clear is the legal or constitutional basis for it?
Well, one of the most interesting features about the Constitution is how much it doesn't discuss. Justice Jackson, in one of his memorable phrases, talked about the great silences of the Constitution, in which what you have to do is to piece together what you think ought to be done based upon very abstract notions of separation of powers or of individual rights. There is not a syllable in the Constitution which addresses the question of immunity by anybody against anybody. And so there's nothing about sovereign immunity with respect to suits against the government in the courts and so forth. There's nothing about interbranch immunity within the federal government. There's nothing about immunities that take place between states and federal government. And all of this stuff essentially is done. And the basic mechanism that one tries to put together is a test which is both necessary and elusive. It says, if you look at a system that has separation of powers, what degree of separation do we have to have by way of immunities in order for the three coordinate branches to be able to work together and to function in one way or another? The first time we actually raised this issue was not in connection with presidential immunity and so forth. The whole case of McCulloch against Maryland asked, amongst other things, the question as to whether or not the United States government had immunity against the state tax, which somebody thought would bring the entire federal system under. And Chief Justice Marshall was prepared to imply that on the grounds that federalism requires some kind of immunity. And you could make exactly the same argument. So what you do is first to look at any particular cases that are so clearly in favor of immunity that you cannot deny the fact that the concept exists and has relevance. So if you assume that the president president has a chief advisor with whom he talks very intensely about various issues, and then somebody says, you know what, everything that the president says to this advisor can be released in any case, what happens is all the benefits of confidentiality go, and the candor that you need in advice is not going to be there. Because remember, in principle, somebody could say, look, I would like to subpoena the president to release the tapes or the recordations of his particular conversation in a private lawsuit having to do with a running down accident that took place in Ohio. And nobody's going to like that. So we know that there is an executive privilege of some sort. And then the question you have to ask is, how strong is that particular privilege? And almost invariably, when you start asking that question, you engage in some kind of a balancing test. What's the nature of the interest that the president has in order to keep the information quiet? What's the nature of the inference that the people who are requesting the information have in order to make it public? And so one of the obvious differences between this and the United States against Nixon, decided in 1974, is that was a criminal trial going against certain people who had worked with the president with respect to Watergate, and there was the possibility of impeachment in the air. This is a civil proceeding trying to get an unredacted version of a report coupled with all of the supporting data, very different issues that are at stake in terms of what's going on. And the president's issue is going to probably come out stronger in this case than it did in the Nixon case. And the government's issue in a non-criminal prosecution is, or the congressional interest, is going to turn out to be weaker.
So there's talk now, because the Justice Department isn't producing the unredacted report, of holding Attorney General Barr in contempt of Congress. That has now, actually, as we're recording this, passed out of the House Judiciary Committee and it's headed to the floor. Some of our listeners may remember that Republicans in the House did the same thing to Eric Holder, who was Barack Obama's Attorney General for most of his tenure, for not turning over documents related to the Operation Fast and Furious controversy. In hindsight, Richard, that doesn't seem like much more than a symbolic gesture of censure. So help us understand how congressional contempt works. If this were to happen to Barr, are there any real consequences?
Well, remember, the Holder thing was an ongoing battle in which there was, I gather, after Fast and Furious, some unexplained deaths, some real complication. And there was no particular claim of privilege that said, I can't release this information to you because it's prohibited by various kinds of rules. And what Holder did is he wanted to hold out. The Republicans got more and more impatient. And eventually, after I think it was about 255 days or close to 9 months, they decided to saddle him with a contempt citation, which essentially was, by and large, a slap on the wrist because there was no enforcement mechanism associated with it. In this particular case, it turns out that the defenses that Barr can offer for not turning over this information are grounded, as I've said, in serious statutory and other kinds of policy concerns. They're not based upon the sort of the confidentiality and the sensitivity of the information. Indeed, one of the things that Barr will stress is, why is the president going to try to keep this stuff quiet if, in fact, the underlying finding of no collusion and no conspiracy is uncontested by anybody? And so they're trying to move faster under these circumstances. They have less cause. There's been less negotiation that's been going on. And in fact, one of the things that the attorney general did was he said, look, I've already given you a bunch of this stuff to for some people to look at. Maybe I can give you a little bit more. I think it's very unlikely that you're going to turn over all of the underlying evidence. That could be thousands upon thousands of pages, volumes, and so forth. If you want a parallel on this, you recall that when they Democrats were after Kavanaugh in the confirmation hearing, what they wanted to do was to get every piece of information that the Judiciary Committee had compiled upon it and to subject it to independent investigation. And this would have been thousands upon thousands of boxes of information. And McConnell and Grassley simply refused to turn that stuff over. And in my judgment, they were right. The question that you have to ask is, given that the Democrats regard Mueller as a man of great probity, what's the likelihood that there's going to be evidence in his particular record that's going to undermine his report, given its length and its complexity? And I think the chances of that are relatively remote, and the dangers that can happen by having people ransack this stuff with leaks and everything else is sufficiently serious that my guess is that nobody would ever order that to take place. Certainly, I don't think that the government can get it, or the Congress can get it, by sending a subpoena on him and saying, well, sanction continue. If they want to do it, they're going to have to go to court. And what they're going to have to do is to throw a pretty high level of necessity on the stuff, most of which of the information which is on the public record. And so I think, in effect, that these cases are really quite different. The Republican sanctions were mild after a long holdout. The Democratic sanctions are going to be very severe after a shorter period where, in fact, as best I can tell, there are independent substantive reasons available to Barr of the sort which were not available to Eric Holder when he faced these sanctions some years ago.
There's been a lot of controversy over who will or won't testify before Congress. Don McGahn, the former White House counsel, has been asked not to by the White House. The administration is signaling, well, the president really directly now, in kind of an about face, that he doesn't want Bob Mueller to testify. Now, those are two different cases. McGahn is a former administration employee. Mueller is technically still with the Justice Department. How much authority does the White House get to assert about whether these people who are not necessarily directly in the chain of command get to testify or not?
This is absolutely terra incognita. I think with respect to McGahn, the position is pretty clear. He is basically bound to confidentiality while he's in office. People turn over all the time, and I think that the obligations of confidentiality follow them after they've left the office. So to give you a homey example, you are a lawyer working on a case and you have confidential information, and you cannot be asked to testify so long as you're in the employ of a particular client. You now retire or resign from the firm, the privilege continues to run against you. It cannot be after you leave the employ of a law firm that you're now free to testify on whatever it is. And so I think Mr. McGahn is going to be clearly judged. Now, the other part of this situation with respect to Mueller is more complicated because it turns out there's a fairly reticulated regime which indicates the terms and conditions under which he works. There was an excellent article by Jack Goldsmith, who teaches at Harvard Law School, on this entire thing on his column, Lawfare, in which he pointed out that there is a detailed agreement between Congress and everybody else telling exactly what it is that Mueller is to do and how it is that he is supposed to do it. And essentially what that arrangement said is that Mueller's sole obligation is to make a recommendation on prosecution, turn the stuff over to the government, that is the Attorney General, after which he's supposed to exit from the scene. Whereas if you start to look at the situation with respect to the United States and Nixon, when they started to figure out how the prosecutor was going to work, that is Jaworski, what they did is they made sure that he was somewhat insulated from the rest of the Justice Department by statute and by regulation, because they know the obvious danger was that Nixon would try to get rid of him in order to essentially carry out his stonewalling of the impeachment process. And when it came to the analysis in the Nixon case, what happened is the Supreme Court unanimously, I think Rehnquist recused himself because he had worked in the White House, said that the interbranch stuff or the intra-branch stuff doesn't carry the day here because of the separation that was created. And so, therefore, the president cannot treat Jaworski as though he's a simple employee and decide to fire him. The firewall was built. In this case, it's exactly the opposite. The way in which the entire program was put together is that Mueller had a limited function. In my view, he misbehaved twice, both seriously in my view. One of them is he starts talking about, I'm not exonerated. That was not part of his mission. He's supposed to only talk about the question of whether or not there's sufficient evidence to prosecute. And if he says there's not, he shouldn't editorialize. And then he wrote the letter of March 27th in which he chastised Barr for not accurately characterizing his report. And that letter was then leaked by somebody, perhaps in the Mueller organization, to the press. That letter should never have been written. It's not his job to deal with the characterization. So I think, in effect, that the president could decide to stop him. That doesn't answer the question as to whether he should. My own view about this is I would much rather see Mr. Mueller testify, because I think that would give the Republicans a chance to really attack him, as well as the Democrats having a chance to defend him. And I think, in effect, that the serious charges against Mueller are extremely important, and that if you start to go through this, you'd ask him not only about the final report, but you ask him about the indictments that he managed to secure along the way. You ask them the question of how come it is that you did not think it was relevant to this inquiry to figure out anything having to do with the Steele dossier or the Democratic irregularities in the FBI. You could ask them, well, we understand you fired Mr. Strotz, but we have another question for you. Normally, when somebody's tainted, you destroy all the evidence that that person has put together and make them start over. Did you do that in this particular case? And it could go on and on. So as far as I'm concerned, having Mueller testify is good. I have, as you know, from the very beginning, taken a very dim view of the way in which he's discharged his office. And I think that if he is hauled before the House for a hearing, it's fine. In addition, by the way, what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. If you can have him testify before the House, you can have him testify before the Senate, and then you'll get a relatively full airing. Now, what's the danger about this? I think it's clear that if he can testify, you have to have somebody sitting on his arm saying, in effect, you cannot testify about anything which is contained in these documents if the information that is in writing is not something that can be released because the redactions were valid. And so I don't think he could go up there and just simply say whatever he wants. If he wants to say, well, you know, I was looking at Mr. X and X is somebody who's protected, or I was thinking about these charges and the grand jury, that's protected, he has to be told that he cannot do this. And so I think, oddly enough, the correct way to do it is to let him testify, but there has to be somebody from the Justice Department which can essentially tell him he has to shush on those things which is not within the power of him or indeed anybody else in the executive branch to go. And let me then sort of explain the last point on this, is the Democrats are saying that, you know, well, you really should go and release all this stuff. I think the correct answer to Mr. Nadler, and I think he's been way over the top on this, is if you want to get this stuff released, you go into federal court, you bring your petition, and then it turns out that the administration will try to fight. You have standing as far as I'm concerned. It's obviously an important issue. But what you have to do is to show why your claim is correct. What I do not think he's allowed to do is to say to Mr. Barr, you think in good conscience you can't do it. I am going to force you to get the release that I want. If you want the release, Mr. Nadler, you go and get it through the House. You've got standing and you can do it. So I think this whole thing has gone way, way offline, and that I'm quite happy to see Mueller testify subject to the constraints that I've talked about. But as far as I can see, the particular case for impeachment on this is nonsensical and non-existent. And I think, in effect, that the person who's been most in abuse of authority is Mr. Nadler himself. And I think, in fact, that he may come to rue some of the more precipitous things that he's done. And Ms. Pelosi, I think, should regret the fact that she starts to call what Barr did criminal on these cases, given the fact that he has a set of justifications for what he's doing, which were not remotely available in the criminal prosecution that was involved in the United States against Nixon back in 1974.
The last thing I want to ask you to weigh in on, it's a little bit of an oddity, but it's a separate but a related issue. As we face the prospect of Attorney General Barr maybe being held in contempt, there are Democrats who are worried that the president could wipe away any consequences of that with a pardon. And so they are now testing the limits of the pardon power. And their test case for this is trying to get a federal appeals court to invalidate the pardon that President Trump gave what now feels like a million years ago to Joe Arpaio, the controversial sheriff from Arizona. Now, here's why this is relevant. Arpaio's pardon was for criminal contempt for ignoring a federal court's instruction to stop his department's immigration patrols. And the Democrats' theory for this case is that president cannot issue a pardon for an offense against another branch of government, in this case, the judiciary. So in other words, Trump can't pardon Arpaio for an offense against the judiciary. He thus can't pardon Barr for an offense against the legislative branch. What's your view on that contention?
Well, I mean, that guts the pardon power completely. As we know, the power is absolute and uninhibited. The only thing that the president cannot pardon, for example, are state offenses, but he can pardon any federal offense. It's probably the case that he could even pardon himself, although that would be ludicrous in many circumstances. I think that most of the people who have pardoned to some extent have committed offenses in all sorts, including many against the judiciary. Many of them are guilty of crimes, which obviously involves the judiciary. So I think, in effect, that this is one of the more preposterous arguments that's ever been stated. The president does have this total power. Now, should he use it is another thing. And as ever, what you do is you have the following kind of conflicting emotions always. The pardon power is as pure and absolute a power as exists inside the Constitution. But what happens is most presidents are very leery of exercising it because they think if they are seen to be arbitrary and capricious or worse, it's going to hurt them politically. So in most cases, what they do is they have a board of pardons and appeals, which has an elaborate internal processes inside the Justice Department to see the way in which these cases ought to be handled. And this has been the source of much contention as to whether or not this has been done correctly or incorrectly over the years. But I think it starts to tell you that what typically happens is that the guys who protest the pardons that a president is willing to give are credible prosecutors who essentially say that what we managed to prove in court is just fine. And I mean, are those cases of offenses against judicial authority and so forth? No, this is not going to work at all. And in fact, it's just part of this game. What the Democrats, I think, have to realize is they have to live with the adverse consequences of the report. What they can do is mount whatever arguments they want politically. They can even decide, I think, if they want to impeach on this. There is no independent judicial check which is going to tell you whether or not something like this is a high crime or misdemeanor. To go back to the Nixon case, the reason why that impeachment carried was very simple. The Republicans essentially realized that the president had been essentially seriously in violation of many laws, including at the last moment obstruction of justice, and they decided they were not going to defend him. And the moment it became clear that the Democrats and the Republicans had a united front, we never had a trial. Richard Nixon resigned because any of that could happen. Bill Clinton was impeached in this kind of a silly case. My own view about it is that the reason the impeachment should have never happened is that it was a complete mistake to say that you can take the deposition of a sitting president, which is what Justice Stevens had decided in Clinton against the United States. At that night it came out, I was actually speaking to the women's board at the city, at the University of Chicago, and I said, I think this is one of the dumbest decisions ever made. If you knew anything about civil procedure, you would realize that depositions are really absolute booby traps of one form or another, and you never want to put the president in a position where he can say something that could be brought against him, as exactly happened in that. So I would have never wanted to prosecute that particular case because I don't think the deposition should have ever happened. And the Democrats stood firm behind the president. The Republicans mounted a kind of a pathetic charge, as far as I can tell, and the thing failed. In this particular case, there's not going to be one Republican who is going to side with the Democrats. And so it will look narrowly partisan, as indeed it turns out to be. And the hope is that there'll be at least some Democrats who will side with the Republican. The basic theory that many of us have, and God knows I'm no political analyst, but I'll give it anyhow, is Nancy Pelosi thinks that if they try to bring an impeachment hearing, which is so utterly single-sided and completely partisan, it will cost the Democrats control of the House and the cost of the presidency and let the Republicans change the Senate. I happen to think that she's right on all of those provisions. But she has a very strong left base, which wants blood from the president. So what she's trying to do is impeachment by proxy, to use a phrase from the Wall Street Journal, trying to beat him up, that is Trump, in every way possible, short of impeachment, so that people who come from swing states, which often vote Republican, are not going to be forced to make a decision one way or another on the impeachment situation. The Democrats would be appalled if they brought the motion and 50 members in the House of Representatives voted against them. They'd be appalled if they managed to get this thing through and then had to present the case and found out that in the Senate they could not, gain a single Republican. What this does is it opens up the horrifying prospect that if the Democrats controlled both houses and they was extreme and erratic in their behavior as they seem to be right now, they actually could get an impeachment through. And they could get a conviction through on stuff which, as far as I'm concerned, is totally gossamer throughout. I think Bill Barr has done a very good job as the Attorney General in this case. I will just mention one point. When I actually wrote about the Mueller report and the stuff having to do with obstruction of justice, I thought the report was completely amateurish and very badly done. Barr had written when he was a citizen a 19-page memo on this in June of 2018, which I thought was much more coherent and persuasive. The difficulty was very simple, is the prosecution or the special report did not want to respect the parameters, that is to give something only having to deal with the sufficiency of the evidence. So what they did is they invented a novel form of report, and that is just not permissible. And then they got everything wrong in terms of the stuff that they omitted and the way in which they did it. This has been a very, very tragic type situation. I think, in effect, that the case of presidential conspiracy or collusion with the Russians was always very weak. I think the Russians understood exactly what they were doing. Namely, what they were trying to do is to sow discord in the United States so that whoever won the president would find that he would have this burden to deal with. And boy, oh boy, did they manage to get a high return on that particular evidence. So I think this thing is a sorry saga from beginning to end.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting definingideas at hoover.org, and you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.